This week on the Dragzine Podcast, we talked to legendary announcer Al Tucci about how he got into the announcing game, what he really likes about announcing, and a whole lot more. So, pull those belts tight, get ready to put in the beans. The Dragzine Podcast starts now. Welcome, everybody, to this week's episode of the Dragzine Podcast. I'm your host, Senior Associate Editor Brian Wagner. Got a really awesome show this week. Get to talk with Al Tucci, one of the great voices of drag racing, and get his take on a lot of different things and kind of what's going on in the sport along. You get to get a little background about Al and how he got into announcing. So, without further ado, let's get this drag racing party started. All right, my guest this week on the Dragzine Podcast is legendary announcer Al Tucci. What's going on, Al?
Hey, how are you, Brian?
Doing good, man. Getting ready to, it's that magical time of the year when there's all kinds of big races going on, and, you know, it's the fun weather. It's getting a little cooler, so we can enjoy ourselves at the track a little more, right?
Absolutely, man. I'm getting ready to do all the finals, Midwest Pro Mod final in a week in Tulsa. Then I'll go, I get to do my very first NHRA race.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they invited the Midwest Pro Mods to go to NHRA Dallas Ennis.
Dude, those
for their national event, and somehow Haney got it through to get this outlaw announcer to go there and announce for him.
Oh, do those boys even know what's coming?
Yeah. I said, if I walk out and the door's cracked, I'm sure someone's going to slam it shut.
You know, if there's one thing that's a given, is that you'll definitely keep it entertaining for sure. And that's an awesome thing. And that's what makes the racing fun for sure. When you have an announcer that isn't a dead fish up there just reading off times.
Yeah. You know, I always pride myself on entertaining, like giving you a ride in the car. I feel like you're riding alongside in the car, and or you're in the passenger seat, and I'm just doing the you know, I feel so energetic watching what's going on and feeling how fast those cars are. I feel like I want to give the fans a ride in the seat, you know. And I know a little bit about mechanicals. I mean, I built my own cars through the years, but I always thought, you know, mechanicals are something, you know, we're there for 5 to 6 hours. Let's sell the excitement. And that's how I've always been. But I do appreciate guys who do explain, you know, the combinations of what makes those cars run.
You know, kind of the speaking for the ride, how did you get on this ride? How did you get into drag racing and becoming an announcer? Because that's not typically, you know, the kind of path that you fall into, unless I guess you're like Brian Lones or something like that.
Yeah, well, I was a young man. I would say a kid. My dad had a car, a street car back in the 70s, and he had a 409 too when I was a baby. And I can remember sitting in the back of that thing going through the gears. And my uncle had a fast car, and I remember sitting in his 55 Chevy with a 409 going through the gears in that thing with no seats, hanging onto the metal because all the upholstery was taken out. I remember being like 4 years old, just gripping onto the metal where the window channels would go in the back seat, just wide eyed, mouth open, going, oh my gosh, man. But it was like an addiction after that. I mean, then I would sit in the garage with my father throughout all the hours he'd go after he'd work. He'd go out in the garage for 2 or 3 hours a night and work on his 1930 Chevy. Had a big block stick. And that was the first car I actually got to drive at 18 down a track. But he did a lot of what isn't safe. But I mean, I'm going to bring it up because he did some street racing in the day with guys from other towns that would come to race him because he had the fastest car around the area. And I watched him race on the street when I was younger, probably 18 years old. But that's basically how I got into it. My dad was into drag cars. Took me to the drag strip as a young kid, me and my brother, and I just stood there by the fence and I was just awed. And after riding in those cars, you could kind of, as a young kid, you could put it together. You understand of how it felt, what you were seeing at that time?
Oh, yeah.
It was pretty cool. But that's basically how I got that deal, and watching my dad mechanically do all the work. And then I had a job pumping gas, and he said, hey, if you want to race the car, you got to help, you know, put tires and rims and all that on it. So I did all that stuff and eventually got to my first race in that car. It was 11:30s. I remember in the quarter mile at 127 with a stick shift. I mean, in 1939, I was always a big guy. I'm a big guy now, but I was always a big kid. And I remember squeezing in that car, man, and getting my knee stuck under the steering wheel and just going for the ride of your life, you know. And in order to drive the car, you had to push your foot down on the clutch and slip the clutch sideways, like, you know, so your knee wouldn't get under the steering wheel. I mean, John Boy Walton really could pull it off. I couldn't. But I did go fast in the car. That was my first car. And, you know, it's pretty cool today if you looked up my brother, Nick Tucci. He redid that whole car, chromolied it for my father so he was safe in it. Now they got a blower on it and they run the sevens.
Oh, nice.
It is. It's kind of unique because it's been around my whole life. And then I see the car now, and my brother, who's a chassis builder, did the deal for him to make, you know, my dad, who's in his 70s, be safe in the car. Because when I was driving that car, Brian, I'm going to tell you what, it was an original 1930 Chevy frame, a straight axle off of 55 Chevy or GMC pickup, a LS6 454 tunnel ram, Muncie rock crusher in it, 12-volt Chevy, 456 gears in it. You know, the tires would hang out from the fenders. It was almost like a nostalgia-style gasser, you know?
Yeah.
Those type of cars. But it was fast. I mean, you go back in 1974, 75.
Oh, 1130s was quick.
Yeah, that car ran 1130s back then. That's a fast car, you know, for a street car.
And that's what's crazy now is just how far we've progressed, because now you can, you know, pick up, you know, almost a nine-second street car from the factory.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that incredible? I mean, who would have ever thought or thunk that? I mean, I can remember back when I was announcing, I did a lot of outlaw street stuff, you know, small tire stuff before it got to be like where it is now with drag radial X275. I remember doing 10.5, where it was a true 10.5 tire. And I was announced. I raced. I had a Chevrolet Nova that I raced in Memphis, Tennessee at the NMCA in 93 and 94. And it was my street car. The car ran 10s in 93, and then it ran 9s in 94. I mean, it qualified pretty well, but, you know, of course, there was guys that were running, you know, 890 and 90s and 950s. But I didn't go there to win. I went there to be a part of that group because I thought that's what the movement should be. I love steel body cars. And, you know, sort of like the Hot Rod Power Tour stuff or the Hot Rod, you know, the drag around the, what is that called when they drag around the five different tracks?
Drag Week.
Yeah, Drag Week. And I love those. You see cars that show up that are cars that are like, wow, man, they don't have to all run in the threes. You understand what I'm saying?
Oh,
yeah. There's a selection for everybody.
Oh, yeah. The thing about Drag Week that's cool is you see so many wild combinations and things that, you know, aren't necessarily fast but cool. And, you know, you got like Johnny Lindbergh and Richie Crompton, you know, stuff yeah. a freaking alcohol funny car motor in a car and drive it on the street.
Oh, God. You know where I come from? Tony Zizzo did that before them in a Willys.
Oh, God, Zizzo.
You know, the Zizzo family. And he's only two towns from me, but I remember that guy in his street Willys with an alcohol burning motor in it. I don't know if he may have even had nitro in it at one time, but he was crazy. Yeah, you know, I'm talking about the father, of course.
Yeah, this Tony TJ ain't too far from the tree for sure. We've had him on the show. It's not a dull moment when TJ's around.
Yeah, those are good people. But I grew up in that area, you know, there was a lot of action going on when I was a kid. I mean, the street cruising scene was big. I was the class clown, which I'm not ashamed of because it got me into what I do today because I love to make people laugh. And when I go to the drag strip with my father, I mean, I tell this story. It's been written in ink. Ian Tocker put it in ink somewhere a couple of times. I used to sit by the door like a dog that had to go to the washroom on Sunday morning, sit there ready to go. Six pack of pop and waiting for my dad to come to the back door so we'd go hook that car up and go to the racetrack. And we'd be. And this is really important because this is what gelled me as being an announcer. I'd go to the track, I'd watch. I was his number one fan, my father. He'd go out in that coupe and make his runs, and I was just a little kid then, you know, 7 or 8 years old. And he built up a history of that car from the town I was in, Libertyville, Illinois, where I grew up. And it was Tucci's coupe. It was the baddest car in the land, you know, sort of like the American Graffiti, right?
That's what I was about to say. It sounds exactly like American Graffiti.
Same thing. Dad had the same hair, smoked Luckies, rolled them up in his T-shirt. Same, I mean, almost the same identical as the movie. He didn't copy it. He just lived the life, you know, in the 60s, racing cars and having fast street cars. But I remember going to the track, and he'd race, and he'd go down that track, and I was so excited as a kid. And then we get ready to go home. He put the van. He had a van. He put the tow bar on. We go home. And I remember my dad always asking me, he'd say, did the announcer say anything? Did he say my name? And I always looked at him. I'm like, yeah, he said Joe Tucci from Liberty Old, the 30 Chevy with a big block Chevy in it, rat motor. And he'd get a grin, and I'd see him smile, and I'll never forget that. It's like it's almost in my mind, you know, wow, that made him more excited than driving the car, that someone acknowledged him. So through all the years of goofing around, and I announced motorcycle racing for ice racing on lakes, frozen lakes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I did. My dad was a champion racer at that, too, locally for AMA. But I did they asked me to announce it because I always was around and I always knew everybody, you know, as a kid. So I learned to do that. Then I did motocross at fairgrounds, supercross style. While I was doing drag racing, I should say how I did get into drag racing. I went to the track, Great Lakes Dragway, when I was a kid, probably 18 years old, 16, 18. And I'd sit and listen. I'd go to the biggest race, the Olympics of drag racing, and I'd listen. And it would be Brett Kepner. I didn't know him at the time. I didn't even know his name. Brett Kepner and another gentleman would be announcing, and I'd be listening and seeing how they built that excitement up and watch the cars, because I love cars. I'm a Chevy guy, but I love everything. Ford, Plymouth, it doesn't matter. If it's a nice looking muscle car, fast car, I love it. But I'd listen, and then I'd sit by the fence by the speaker on like a Wednesday night or a Saturday night, and I'd announce. It was just bizarre. I would just do all the talking. My buddies like would laugh at me. And I was just doing it like off the hip, and the owner of the track walked by and heard me. He said, are you an announcer? I said, no, I just love cars. And he heard me talking. He goes, would you go up there and try it? This was Broadway Bob Metzler, one of the greatest promoters ever in drag racing history. And he said, yeah, go on up there. So I go up there, Brian, and I get on they had like the police radios, you know, the ones you key up.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? And then that's when they had the timing machine, is it a Krondek, I believe?
Yeah.
They would do they do the timing. You could watch the numbers, you know, on digitally going, you know, little yellow numbers clicking along. And I'd watch that. And I'm going up there, and I don't want to say it, but I was a natural right off the bat. I didn't even use that machine or look at that stuff. I just looked at cars, and whatever the car expressed, I expressed. You understand? Like if I saw a huge wheelie or a beautiful burnout, I was just on it. You know, it was almost like I was, you know, like I said, driving the car or something. But the guy made me go get him hot dogs, this other announcer. He made me go get him pops. I swear to God, I wore a pair of tennis shoes out in one night getting this guy everything. He didn't want me on the PA, I guess. So, yeah, exactly. So I told old Broadway, I said, I'm not cut out for this. I go, thank you, though, but I'm not going to run around and get that guy everything. You know, that's not what I want to do. If you want me to talk, I'll talk, but I'm not going to be his gopher. So years went by. I say I was probably 24, 25 or something. I've been announcing 34 years now, so I'm 57, so take the math and do the math. And that's when I really first went up there. He saw me at the track, Broadway did, and he said, hey, I remember you. Remember? I go, yeah, but I'm not chasing hot dogs and pop. He goes, no, that guy's gone. Would you try it again? And then the rest is history. The minute I got up there, I was just locked in and just calling Wednesday night bracket races or grudge racing, test and tune. I mean, I did so many nights, you know, Wednesday, Saturday nights, Sunday afternoons of announcing at one of the, probably the premier, excuse me, tracks in the country at that time for that type of racing, bracket racing. It was Broadway Bob's Great Lakes Dragway. And I only say that not to be biased because I'm from there, but I mean, all the big names came there. You know how they travel today, big bracket races.
Oh yeah.
And that's how this is really how I got recognized. I mean, as an announcer, I was up there on a bracket, $10,000 bracket race. And
back then that was huge money.
Oh God. Yeah. This would have been in the '80s and you know, probably in the late '80s, but, a gentleman named he's passed by now, but a gentleman named Jim Ledford, who owns Stanton, Michigan, along with his wife and his kids, Mikey and Jeffrey. And these kids were not even have driver's license and they're in dragsters and they were so phenomenal. And I'm announcing a race and I'm of course going off the hip and just being me, you know, being crazy and having fun. And that gentleman came up. This would have been my first time ever anyone came up and asked me to go to a different track. I'd been at the Grove for like 3 years, and this guy said, I don't know who you are, but man, I was so entertained. Would you come to my track? I'll pay you this. I'll give you a hotel, and I'll give you what you need to get paid. And then I asked, this is a funny part, because I asked Broadway Bob, I said, well, this guy wants me to travel. And he said, you know what? You're a good announcer. You should get just what everyone else makes. And I said, what's that? And he tells me this big number, you know, for the day, I don't know, probably for a weekend, it was $350 or something for 2 days. I'm like, really? How come you only pay me $10 an hour? That's what I said to him. He goes, he's like, I didn't know how to, you know, add or subtract at 25 or 7 years old. That was funny. And he's just like, oh, don't worry about me. I'm just trying to help you now. Don't cut yourself short. You're a great announcer. So Ledford hired me, and that was the first man. And I will tell you, still to this day, you ever heard, Brian, where they say, don't forget where you come from, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
That's totally me. I will never forget where I came from, meaning in this industry. When that man hired me and let me work at that Mid-Michigan Motorplex and call a race, and it's just like it took off from there. I mean, I had the blessings of a lot of people in the racing industry that said, wow, this guy's good, and you know, you should take him on. And I did, you know, some heads up racing and some top sportsman stuff over there, but I never forgot it. I mean, I did for Jim Ledford, I announced a lot of times in a lot of private races. And then when Super Street racing got big, if you remember, you're a young guy. How old are you, Brian?
I'm 39 years old.
Yeah, you're a young guy. You know what I mean? So I'm sure the history's there for you to read and look at, but when NMCA was big in 94, 95, how old were you in 95?
Oh, gosh, I was probably maybe, 15, 16 years old. Yeah, something like
how
that.
How old?
15, 16 years old.
Yeah, almost. Okay. So you'd have been old enough to enjoy it and remember probably, but I can remember doing, when those cars invaded Memphis with the NMCA, Russ Smeltnick's, Alan Scrimmager was the manager for the NMCA. When they invaded, there was Pro Street, there was Pat Musi, there was Tony Christian. There were so many big names. And that summer, I mean, but the Super Street guys, it was so bizarre to see the crowd. You know, it was almost like the old saying, you know, win on Sunday, sell them on Monday. You know, that old drag racing saying.
Oh, yeah,
it was
for
almost
sure.
Just like that, because here's all these steel bodied flat hood cars that are just invading the place going in the 9 second range, you know, 98% of them, except for like Landon Jordan and Todd Moyer, who could dip into the high eights, you know, 90s, 890s. But it was incredible to see how the reaction was from the fans of how they would accept those cars. And I was like, wow, this is it, man. I started announcing at NMCA after I was racing there. I'd go to work for them. And it just took my career to a different level. to be able to work for the NMCA. And then, you know, and they're existing today, and I've worked for them on and off throughout the years, you know. But it just was so neat to see what Super Street evolved to. And then it just almost got so crazy, you know, to the Outlaw Super Street, Outlaw 10-5s out in Georgia, and the Outlaw Streetcar Association, all that stuff. It just got way, in my opinion, out of hand. It turned from more of a muscle car and a street car to a trailer car and almost a mini Pro Mod style deal. As you see for yourself in any X275 today, that is a serious race car.
Oh, yeah, racers. It's funny to watch how racing has kind of progressed. And, you know, just the time that I've really been into hardcore, you know, radial tire, small tire, outlaw, heads up racing, just how it's all kind of progressed at like this accelerated rate. And it's just, it's awesome. And it's insane at the same time to watch all of this happen.
It is. I mean, and you brought it up earlier about technology and how things have changed. And you go to a race today and pardon my French, but everything's in the threes, if you think about it, right? Or very close to it. Oh. You know, your Pro Mod's running 350, 360. Drag radial car, Pro Mod 350, 360. I just saw a kid in a MX235 car running the fours. I mean, it's incredible where this stuff goes, you know, and the technology and the turbo. And, you know, I can remember turbo cars back in the 80s at our local track that ran like crap.
Oh, it was black magic, yeah, back then. People didn't know how to make it work.
Yeah, it was just like, you know, there's a guy probably Duttweiler in California or on the salt flats in Bonneville that's making it work, you know, with getting the thing motivated and moving, you know, to start feeding the fuel to it. But in drag racing, it really wasn't something that was being utilized. I can remember cars just, you know, spitting black smoke out, not running good. And then, you know, you get into the 90s and the middle 90s, NMCA guys experimenting, you know, you had the tweaked Chevrolet. Or Buick, excuse me, of Lawrence Conley out of Texas. And then he went into the Chevrolet Camaro later on. But, you know, a lot of people don't know. That man he's an engineer by trade, but I got to know him. And he said, oh, I'm trying this today, or I'm trying that this week, or next race we go to, I'm trying this. And I'm like, the car is fast. What are you trying? He goes, I experiment every race to make this turbo car better. You know, with fuel systems and different types of, you know, boost controlling and all that. And I was just amazed when he said that. You know, here you're seeing a 200-mile-an-hour car running in the sixes well into it, and he's testing, you know what I'm saying, while he's racing.
Oh, yeah. Any of those guys that have always ever been on the bleeding edge, whether it's, you know, the old school nitro guys like Don Garlitz, you know, your pro stock racers like WJ, you know, your heads up guys of today, they're always tweaking, plotting and planning and trying to come up with any little edge they can come up with. They think it might go faster, and then they pull the pin and hope the grenade doesn't blow up.
Yeah, no, that's so true. And I mean, you bring up a great point, and today, I just salute those people, all of them, because what you're seeing today in Pro Mod and even in Pro Stock, you know, even though a lot of people don't agree with the way Pro Stock has turned out. I mean, racing's racing, and, you know, I've never been in the category, but you have to feel for the guys that, you know, built it or brought it to the category and that's been changed. But I would say hat off to all those pioneers, man, the ones that, you know, lost their lives and the ones that, you know, crashed or did things to make it safer and better. Without all that stuff, and it's easy to look into a book and go back in history, and when you see some of the stuff compared to seeing the stuff today, it almost make your eyes roll, won't it?
Oh, when I go to the Detroit Autorama each year, past couple of years, to check things out, you know, find some cool stories. And this past year, they had a big display of nostalgia, funny cars, and front engine dragsters. I'm taking pictures and checking these things out, and I'm taking a close look at these chassis, and the thing that pops in my mind is, how did more people not get killed driving these things?
Isn't that the truth?
I mean, just looking at the structure and the build, I'm like, you talk about having balls of steel to jump in one of these things.
Absolutely.
With a nitro engine, it has none of the current technology to keep that thing even – somewhat under control. It was basically a wild animal that drank nitromethane, and you know, you mashed the loud pedal and hoped it made it down the track and didn't start throwing rotating assembly parts at you.
And it's, you know, it's again, you bring up another great point to watch the history of it. And when you go back and watch Top Fuel when they're front engine dragsters, and you get to see the history of how it really worked, it's almost like those were the guinea pigs, you know, the dudes in the seat. Those dudes were just, hey, it really runs good this way with this magneto. When you floor it, it really burns the fuel good. And, you know, they go out there and the tires are burned. That alone, when the tires are burned up, the car's got to be a handful to control, right, until they hook up.
Yeah, open-face helmets with gas masks.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just all those things. And I remember that. I remember my dad telling me as a young kid, God, Stone, Woods, and Cook. One day I won. He goes, that was a dream of his to maybe build a Willis. You know, he always wanted to do that. He always shared that at the dinner table with me and my brother. You know, he'd say, you know, I that would have been my dream, you know, but I had kids and stuff. And he had the car with a guy. Then the guy had lost his life in a car accident, so they never pursued it. But just stuff like that. And you know, the unique thing about myself, and not to harp on myself, but I've met so many people that I heard stories about as a kid.
Isn't that a mind trip?
Excuse me?
Isn't that a mind trip when that happens?
Oh, totally. I mean, I've eaten lunch with Don Garlitz. I've sat at a, you know, at a banquet with him in Florida when I worked for Super Chevy announcing for them. And he was the master of ceremony, and he was like running for politicians or something. And he had a big dinner, and I went to it, and it was so cool to see, you know, the people and the just to meet him. You know, true story is, and he, I don't know if you'll remember, and he does have a good memory. But me and my brother were at the track, and we were like 4 years old, 5 years old, and they're coming down the return road, and I'll never forget. There's rocks there in front of our feet, and we're throwing rocks at each other. All of a sudden, I'm throwing rocks at Garlitz's swamp rat coming by. And it's a true story. My dad beat my ass so bad that day. What are you doing? You know, we were just little kids throwing rocks. But I remember you threw rocks at Big Daddy Don Garlitz's car. And here I was eating lunch with him, you know, 20 years later or 20 something years later. And I'm just like, wow, it's almost like it was meant to be. I feel that sometimes, like, I get to live a piece of history, you know, from what I did. And 34 years of announcing drag racing, you can only imagine the things I've seen.
Oh, yeah.
And the tracks I've been to, and the cars progress to where they are. And the people I've met, that's the most important thing. I love everybody in this sport. I mean, there isn't one of them I won't, you know, I'm so low-keyed. I'm just happy to see everybody. You know, if you meet someone or a fan that likes you, or, you know, a racer, I always try to take that time to say, you know, you're awesome, or you'll be there, you know, just keep going. You know, it'll be $1,200,000, but you'll get there if you want to be as fast as that guy. You know, there's just some crazy stuff, but I think it's been an awesome run. And to be every association I worked for, the NMCA, when they in '90s, you know, in the '95, '96, for many years. Then I worked for the NSCA, the National Streetcar Association, when Tony DiPillo split, and they split the car counts, and I went to work for them. I was invited. It's in Superstock magazine somewhere. I was going to be the announcer for IHRA, Bill Bader Sr., the father. It would be not Junior and not the young kid there now, but his father.
Oh yeah,
had sent me and asked me to if I would be the announcer for IHRA when he purchased it. I said, me for real? He goes, yes, you for real. So, and to make a long story short, I accepted the deal, and then within, I would say, a week or two, I rejected the deal because of other management. I won't go into that, but it was just bizarre story of who was working under him, other people that made my life a little harder to want to do it. So I, but it made ink in Superstock. And I could have been there. I always wanted to be an NHRA announcer. This is what's weird. When I was a kid doing it, I say a kid 20 something years old, but I always wanted to be in the NHRA. And I did a lot of divisional races at my local track with Bob Fry. And, you know, I just took his lead. You know, he'd do something and say, "Hey, you want to do something?" I said, "I'd love to do the pro stocks, you know, the not the ones that you see on a national circuit, but the local ones." And he let me do that. And he just looked at me, and the guy kind of awed and said, "Are you for real?" I'm like, "Yeah, don't you feel it? You know, I feel like I'm in that car." He said, "Wow." So I got to work with that guy. I worked with a lot of guys, and I always loved working with other announcers. I do to this day. I mean, if there's someone that is gold out there, like I told you, I don't forget where I came from, Brian. And, you know, there's a young kid right now that reminds me a lot of myself from Texas. He's from Louisiana. And I worked with him in Texas at Ennis. And I'm like, "God, man, this kid is so good." He was 17 or 18 years old. And this kid was like gifted. And he's still, you know, he's still out there. And I work with him in Midwest Pro Mods every now and then. His name's Colton Jordan, if you'll hear of him ever. He's just a young kid coming. But, you know, it's amazing what the computers today and, you know, the internet can do for someone in this industry.
Oh, yeah.
For the history. I mean, this kid was dropping stuff. I go, "Man, you weren't even in Kimby's, and you know that?" He goes, "Yeah, but I read it all on the internet, and I went back and researched the history, and it's just amazing, you know." And it just made him, it took probably 15 years of experience to put on him as a good announcer, you know. But he's now working at Tulsa Raceway Park, and he's in the management, and he's doing some drag boat stuff for some Texas association. But I'm just saying, I'm not dropping his name, but I'm telling you, that'll be someone you'll hear up and coming, you know, when you're what, you're 38, 40, when you're 58, you'll hear how good that kid is.
You know, it's something you kind of mentioned a little bit earlier, kind of want to unpack it a little bit more. I think it'd be an interesting to get your take on this. You know, like you said, it's documented. You were part of the small tire outlaw racing scene for so long. And you were probably one of the first people to really get to see a lot of this, you know, back in the day, the Outlaw 10-5 Freak Show come about. What was that like to see that madness unfold in real time? You know,
that was incredible. That was like, you know, that was like if you're at a pro mod race today and a guy like Marcus Burt won a 57, right? And you're just, your jaw hits the ground. You're like, "You got to be kidding me." Nitrous oxide car 57. But that was the same way back then. You know, when those Outlaw 10-5 cars were started, and Mickey Thompson, of course, the Mickey Thompson probably holds almost all the records, I got to say. They do. It's an incredible company. I worked alongside of them and their races that they sponsored for many years. But when they perfect the tire and they give it to someone to use, and you go back and you watch – I'll just bring it up to getting to Georgia, to the Outlaw deal. Steve Kirk Jr., Marcus Burt, the late Steve Grebeck. I mean, I remember him and Steve Halloprin's Mustang at a little track called Macon, Georgia. Not what it is today, because someone put millions of dollars into that track. I remember when you took a gravel road, got into the track, and it was a miniature golf course, man. I'm like, "They're going to race here? Where are they going to put everybody? You know, where are they going to put the cars if everyone shows up?" And they packed that place. And you remember, not to bring up any great art, but you remember Picnic in the Park, that picture of art with everyone walking around in the park in their dresses and their top hats?
Oh, yeah, impressionist stuff.
Totally what that reminded me of, that race. It was my first time. Some guy, Jerry, out of New York, bought that track. Him and his kids ran it, and they called me up. So we heard about you. We'd like you to announce it. I said, "Sure. You know, this is what I get." They sent me in. But I go there, man. It was a festival, man. I'm telling you, barbecues going on the fence, people standing. I can't replace this in my mind. I mean, these super tracks they built, someone needs to go back and build a track that's old looking you know, to so everyone looks like they're there. You know what I'm saying? It's
Oh.
just, but I went to there and I watched the cars and the axe man, the guy I'm talking about, Marcus Burt, who we just watched go 357. I've known the man over 20 years. I knew when he was a hired gun and he getting Jack Barfield's yellow Chevrolet Camaro, an Outlaw 10-5, and just chopped the tree down. That's how I get the name the Axe Man, and just put that 10-5 tire on the bumper, man. And Steve Kirk Jr., who raced many years in NMCA and Pro Street, then he worked his way into the small tire deal, and he was just another incredible guy, man. There was a guy that if you saw the red trailer pull in, the red cars pull out, you knew for sure you better be on your game because that guy was going to be there for the taking. And like I said, the late Steve Grebeck, Jim Huber, and his Pick S10 truck. I mean, I was there, Steve, Scavo, when he was driving for D'Agostino's Camaro the first time. But I was there when those guys all started doing that outlaw stuff, you know, the outlaw racing before the association got really big. I remember all the outlaw races, you know, the Orlando Speed World, you know, the World Street Nationals. That was the biggest race you could ever attend at that time. And he had the perfect formula. Carl Weisinger had the perfect formula, and I don't care what anyone says. He had a rule book that probably was 2 pages for every class, and he went from like a drag radial car. He had drag radial, that import drag radial, Outlaw 10-5, and he had Pro Street. He had 4 to 5 classes at the most there. And what was so cool about it, which I miss today as a spectator of racing, I would say if I was a spectator, everything was easy to read. It wasn't like today when you got a 3 second Pro Mod, then a 3 second X275 guy. You know what I'm saying? It was the everything was sevens, eights, nines. You know what I mean? His classes went from 7 second Pro Street to high seven to 8 second Super Street back in the day. Outlaw 10-5, excuse me, and then the drag radial guys, you know, running in their category in the quarter mile. But it was easy for a spectator to watch because you could say, oh, here comes the fast guys. Today, you know, you go to a big drag radial race and it's like everybody is running so damn fast. You know what I'm saying, Brian?
Oh
In
yeah.
every case,
Yeah, it's
it's almost like you really have to have a technician there on the PA to tell you, hey, well, this class weighs this, and that's why they run this. But, you know, is there any excitement or energy junkie goes to a race, you know, but you're watching everything. You're, God, man, but why is that little car on an X275 almost as fast as that, you know, that the next class, you know, radial versus the world, you know, they're running 350s, 360s, and here's those guys going into the 390s, you know, with the X275 cars. It's insane to see the progression,
Oh, yeah, it's
you know.
technology. Again, it all circles back to
It
tech.
is.
The
It is.
technology and racers go together like peanut butter jelly because they use technology to figure out to go faster and how to circumvent the rules. Because I remember for the longest time, you know, people never go that fast on a radial. And then they figured out how. Well, we're going to have to throw another rule at them. You know, let's change this. Racers always find a way to go faster and beat the other person, and they will put themselves into crushing debt to do it. That's just the
Yeah.
mindset.
Yeah, that's so true. God, you say that. You remember when the radials would wobble?
Oh, yeah.
Go and they had got that high speed wobble going. I forget they had a name for that, but those cars would move around. It's like, oh my God.
Call it a death wobble in a Jeep.
Yeah, it might as well have been. That's back when Singleton was running his Nova and the guys like that. And God, they were so fast. And just to watch how they've changed and how, like you said, they find tuners that just understand and, you know, guys that really know how to make development changes in those chassis and the suspensions. You know, they tell the stories of Mark Mentzer, how he can touch your car and find you 2 tenths. And it's true. I
Oh,
mean, you
yeah.
in today's world, Bri, you almost have to. I've said this so many times to racers, you know, guys that have the equipment, but they don't have the numbers coming up. I said, why don't you spend the $2,000 and get that guy, you know, get ZZ Laptop, Ledford, you know, Josh, hire him for a weekend. You'll be amazed what those guys will do when they tune your car. Well, you know, Joe Opalski from Hyperactive. I mean, those guys that do that and get paid to do it, it's well worth it because, man, it'll cut so much time out of your car and it'll cut so many corners of wasted money. You know, I've seen that over the last 20 years.
Well, circling to kind of what, you know, person you mentioned there, Marcus, you know, look, he brought in Stevie Jackson and all of a sudden he went from, oh, it's another guy with a radial tire nitrous pro mod to, oh my God, look how fast he went to, okay, now he's the baddest man on a radial on nitrous.
On earth.
I mean, it's just, it's insane.
Isn't it? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and, you know, I've snapped some pictures of that car when Stevie got a hold of it and just the level of chassis separation and just how angry that car is going down the track.
It look like a late model stock car?
Yeah.
The way it gets up. If you look at it, if you took a picture of it and turned it sideways on your phone and just and zoomed it into a dirt track, it just looks, it reminds me of a late model, the way they get up off the chassis and just plant the tire down. I mean, it's incredible. But you know what? You're making me smile because, you know, Marcus Burt is the absolute most genuine guy. If me and you helped him make the best lemonade, he'd tell, you know, Brian and Al helped me do that. He's a driver, man. He is a driver. His job is to get in that car and go before the green comes down and know that he's going to be green when he leaves. And he'll tell anybody that. And I've watched him for so many years. He's like one of the greatest drivers. You know, I can remember him when he was racing in the Outlaw 10-5. I remember when he's a grudge racer. I mean, I tell a story of him racing a four-door Impala, like an 87 Chevy, those big four doors with a 672 cubic inch nitrous fed big block in it. And he was racing for like $2,000 at one of these old tracks. And I was there announcing a race and I watched this guy drive that car. And I said, man, he was so far ahead of his time for wheeling a car. I mean, he went guardrail to center line, but kept that thing and won that race. And that's all those guys would care about. They'd hire him. You win the race. He'd win the race. And he'd beg me because he knew I had a touring professionalism of going everywhere. Could you ask Roy Hill? He'd say to me, I want to drive a pro mod so bad. And I said, I could ask him, but, you know, I don't know what will happen. And I asked him and he just said, yeah, well, you know, it isn't like that today. You know, a lot of guys have to either have their own car or pay someone to drive. But that guy's a driving fool, man. He is so good. And he's so humble from his upbringing and where he's been. He's worked so hard to get where he is today and be able to afford what he's doing. That is cool. And I wish that guy the best. Wherever he goes, I wish him the best, you know. You may go back to seeing him being a driver again. But he did give Stevie all that credit. He did give Billy Stocklin all the credit, Pat Musi the credit, because he got in that rocket ship and just put it down, you know. But that is incredible. The technology where they are on a drag radial just blows my mind. And I was in, let me tell you, you don't mind me telling you, I was at the Shakedown, which was phenomenal. Oh, yeah. I mean, Tyler Crosno, manager of Virginia Motorsports Park, the Franklin family owns it, but I'm telling you, they brought that race to the level that it's never been before anywhere. Even though it was at Norwalk for 4 or 5 years, I did the race for 11 years straight since its inception. I was the announcer. And a couple weeks before that race, I got a call. Hey, do you want to come and announce the race with Brian Lones? I said, sure, man. I'll come and announce that race. That race means a lot to me because a lot of the 10-5 guys that I used to announce will be there. But it was incredible. I mean, that kid put the drag radials versus the pro mods on a Friday night, lane prep for pro mod, lane prep for drag radial. And I'm telling you, that was something that was just a cherishable moment. If you weren't in the seats or watching that on a live feed, I can't tell you what you missed.
You know, that whole event and just like you said, the build up to it, you know, that is one of the things that I will give props to Tyler for in the events that he promotes is that he makes it a show. He gets it. He gets that, you know, it's hard to get entertainment dollars out of people today, and you got to put on a show. You got to draw them in, you know, like, you know, the old, you know, when I was growing up, you know, going to Thompson Raceway Park up in, you know, Northeast Ohio with my family, it'd be the funny car fox hunting, you know, match racing with pro stock guys and bracket racing and jet cars. You just, you suck the fans in with that. And that show right there, that had people talking. For pro mods, against pro mods, loving radios, it gets people talking, and it keeps building this momentum up. And, you know, then Marcus lays down those 57s. Now it's like, oh, now what's going to happen at No Mercy? It just keeps building.
Isn't it something?
It builds
it's
on it.
It's something, and it is. And it's, you know, right, and we'll go back a little bit. And I talked to Wes Buck at Drag Illustrated the night at, was it Sweet 16 or No Mercy when Marcus went fast in that nitrous vet? I don't remember what race it was.
Sweet 16 was when he went the 360 something.
Yeah. All right. It was a 60 flat, wasn't it? With change?
Yeah. Yeah. Something like that.
61 or 60. Yeah.
61.
And you had a lot of guys fighting for the numbers. I mean, it was good numbers and stuff. But I remember that night, and I privately text Wes Buck. Because remember, everybody was complaining, nitrous is done. We don't have a chance anymore. We can't do it. These blowers and these pro chargers and these turbos are destroying us. And when that happened, I still have it on my phone somewhere. I texted Wes Buck and said, look at what this kid just did, Marcus Burt, at this race. He just went this fast on nitrous oxide. Everybody's been talking about how it's done, nitrous. I go, this is your chance to say nitrous ain't dead. Get on there. Give this guy the ink he deserves. Call him right now. I gave him the guy's number. Regardless if I know him or not, Brian, I know what the market needs. You know, it's sometimes I've been one of those guys. I don't need the accolades or the handshake, but I do see things that will make an appearance. You understand?
Oh, yeah.
That'll make a change. And he got on it. He set his guys up on it. And he talked to Marcus Burt, and he did such an awesome job. And then look where it's led to. You know, it only makes the pioneers of nitrous oxide excited. You know, the ones that are here today and the ones that aren't, because it's been a NOS, I would say. You know, Mike Thermos and those guys put a lot of money in marketing and nitrous oxide to this day. You know, and it's well deserving, because I remember in the beginning, the turbo guys didn't put the money into it. They came to the race, kicked your ass, took the payroll, but you know, and then a nitrous company sponsoring the event. I'm like, you know, I'm just saying, a lot of the races I've seen, I said, this ain't fair, man. And I would talk it up and tell guys, why don't you put money into it? You know, your turbo, it's only going to make you guys better. It's going to make guys want to build a turbo. And then they'd do it, you know, Harry Ruska would do that and put big dollars up, which was good. He really changed the whole turbo movement, if you think about it, and you go back to the history.
I got to see him actually the weekend of the Shakedown. My wife's big into drag racing too, and the No Prep Kings deal was up at Norwalk, you know, a couple hours from my house, and we went up there, and Harry rolls that old Pro Mod out there on that less than optimal surface, and you know what, he wheeled and dealed that thing right down the track like, you know, it was like it was a dirt late model car. And
was it moving around?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, jeez.
And you know, I don't know what your thoughts on No Prep are. For me, I used to think this is the dumbest thing ever, and then I went to a race and I'm like, this is like old school, like outlaw tracks. It has that street race feel. I mean, it in the and the demographic for that is what companies drool over. 18 to whatever, males, young people, they have their fans. It's like the old days, you know. The way I akin it to is like how people love to cheer for John Force. That's how all these No Prep fans are with their favorite drivers. It doesn't matter if they're on TV or not on TV. It's nuts.
And I will tell you what I feel, that racing's racing. I mean, I've talked to Pat Musi, his daughter does it. And he said, man, Tooch, I cannot believe, this isn't Pat's word, how many people and the crowd. And it felt like the old times, man, at pro street racing, you know, we didn't have all the glue on the track. You know, we'd break tires loose. And I can remember all of it because I was there. And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, you know, and now we got more horsepower, of course. But now you got to, you know, learn to drive the car. That's the biggest thing. Tune the car so that it's not blowing the tires off. You know, give it the safest you can. And you'll see that. And most of those days, I'm not saying anyone can't crash, but man, most of those days, those guys get those cars down those tracks. They tune those cars to those tracks and that racing surface. And to watch it, what you're saying, I'm saying, hey, it's racing. It's good to see the sport. You know, I think Daddy Dave, I say it again, he's America's outlaw street driver. That guy, I've watched him jump in Keith Haney's Pro Mod, run right in the 3 second range, never drove a Pro Mod. The guy can drive anything. I mean, he's just one of those gifted people. But it's the world of people seeing that we are close to being what you are. And I mean this by, like, I work at Midas, let's say, and I do exhaust. Then you see Dave owns a machine, automotive shop. Wow, I do that same thing. Do you understand? It's not some millionaire.
Oh, yeah.
You know, selling battery chargers or something, and you'll never, you know, you could be him, but you just think in your mind, oh, I'm light years away from being that guy. But it's almost like you said, the demographics they love because the kids are into it. People are pumped up, but it's blue collar. And you know what I mean? And you get that feeling, I could do this, you know, just like you got back in the 60s and the 70s in drag racing. I could do this. It's the same feeling.
Oh, yeah. And that, you know, I talked to Dwayne Mills at Outlaw Armageddon about this year. I was interviewing him for our coverage, and he told me something interesting. He said, all's no prep is racing 20 years ago with more horsepower. He said,
there you go.
You didn't have that. This track, you know, the radial, you know, even the modern slick tire prep you have. He goes, it wasn't like this. He goes, it was like what we're doing now. And, you know, at that moment, I'm like, that totally, totally makes sense. And it's wild to watch these cars get down the track. And some of the guys will divulge some of the numbers to me. And to say these cars are slow, you're very wrong.
They're on the very edge of high threes all the time.
And that's
the car's fast.
And that's the thing, is you got someone like, you know, Ryan Martin, Fireball, that has ran that exact car in radial versus the world trim and gone to the semis, you know?
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
It's
just what he said to you was perfect. You know, Dwayne Mills is such a nice guy. There's another guy I just love to death. He's a good, hardworking man. Deserves all the fame and everything he gets, because he don't just buy it. He earns it. He drives for it. I can remember him back at Ducks races back in the day, you know, and he was just a badass dude. Him and Jason Mihalik and, you know, the old Niner cars. But that guy said the right thing to you. We just have more power. That's what Pat Musi said to me. You have to control the power. So what is the on any given day, what is the formula that you're hearing? You know, you hear 4,000 horsepower out of a twin turbo car, right? Like Fireball or
thing
of 4,000 horsepower.
Yeah.
So do you need 4,000 horsepower? Are you going to utilize it?
Oh, yeah. Even on a radial tire, even a Pro Mod, you're not going to use every bit. It's, you know, it's like you said, it's power management. And I think that kind of circles around to, again, why we're seeing some of these insane performances over the last, you know, 5 years, 6 years, is that power management has gotten so much better in all forms of drag racing, door car racing. I exclude nitro cars because that's a whole, like, that's controlled chaos, barely controlled chaos. Pro stock cars, you know, that's like squeezing every last ounce of blood out of the turnip, but it's still power management, just on a much more precise, fine-tuned level.
You know who I'd love to see go do that? Because it's almost like Jim Jones. Everybody's drinking the punch, thinking you need all those huge horsepower turbo motors. I'd love to see Andy Jensen in one of his old small block turbo entries. Do you remember him?
Yeah, I remember the name, yeah.
The Camaro, the Corvette. And I remember him showing up and everybody, guy's a small block. I'm like, yeah, but that guy ran with the best because he didn't have all that torque. He wasn't blowing the tires off. And he knew how to tune that car for that day. But I'd love to see some guy wheel out there with some small block with twins on it.
There's a dude that does it.
And let the thing eat.
There's a dude in the PDRA that does it. I forget his name. He drives a blue Camaro. It's a small cubic inch engine, twin turbos with a clutch, and that car straight smashes people.
That may be him. That may be Andy Jensen.
Oh, that car is nasty.
Do you remember where he's from?
Oh, I do not remember. I can picture the car plain as day in my head. It's blue.
Is it like a medium blue?
Medium blue with racing stripes.
I wonder if that's him. Oh. I mean, the guy's so tent was so never got the accolades he deserved. I mean, people will disagree that I say that, but you know, that guy was like the silent hitter. You know, he comes in and it's like, you got to be kidding me. You know, there's this guy named Judd that did this at the Midwest Pro Mods. I don't know if you ever saw that car. I think his name's Dumkey, if I'm not right here. I've only seen him once. He was in Memphis a couple weeks ago. Shelby, 67, I believe. Twin turbos. A clutch in the car. Came right out, went 370s with the fastest guys in the field. And nobody had seen it. And I remember Brandon Schweitzer coming up to me at the airport. Did you see that Mustang? That was a clutch. I go, really? So he got my curiosity going. He goes, it was a clutch, man, and their hands weren't dirty. None of them. I'm like, what? He goes, I used to do a clutch, and we'd be like elbow to fingertips, filthy. He goes, none of them were dirty. I had to go look. I couldn't believe my eyes. So I got a hold of this guy on Facebook, this Judd. He's from Southern Illinois. And I said, hey, you know, I was sitting there talking to one of the best tuners in the world. And he couldn't believe you had a clutch. You know, he said no one was dirty. He says, tell him we have good hand cleaner. That's what he puts out. He goes, and I've got old junk. He goes, I want to say it's junk, but all my turbos are old. Everything's old on my car. I'm so far behind the times. He goes, but I thrive on, you know, stuff like that. If I can come there and race with the best guys and perform and get in the fourth spot in qualifying or whatever he got that day, that's what I thrive on. It was pretty cool. Those dudes were firing that thing up with starting fluid. Boom! And bang in the lanes. I'm like, what in the hell is that? These guys are putting starting fluid to bring it to life. But it is pretty cool. I mean, just the things you see, it just goes back to another thing you can put in your old mind of how impressive people are and this sport really is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, look at the Bruder brothers that... Those guys are like specialists in analyzing a rule book and finding a combination, zooming in, maximizing it to the point where they give John Sears an ulcer because no one can like replicate or keep up with what they're doing.
Isn't that something? Oh. And it's so true. And they're just smart, talented people.
Oh.
And they read it. And you know, back in the 90s, who did that? Chuck Samuels. From Chicago. That guy could read the rule book and build a car and stomp your ass. I mean, and they'd go, well, is this fair? Hey, show me in the rule book where it says it isn't. He had split dominators on one car and it never said that you couldn't have that. And he got it to, you know, he built it around, you know, building a big pro mod style or pro stock style motor. And then put nitrous oxide to it. I mean, he did such incredible things, everything he built, but it was the same as the Bruders. He went home, he opened the rule book, and he started to read, and he started to take notes, and he built stuff around the rule book that they couldn't say, oh, you can't do this. You know, then they had to start adding weight instead of saying you can't do that. You know, but I mean, Billy Glidden, I'll say this again. I watched him come into streets small tire racing, and people said, oh man, you can't beat Billy Glidden, that guy's unreal. I said, listen guys, I'm only gonna say this once, and there's no disrespect to any racer that's sitting in the staging lanes right now. You can't race a thoroughbred with a glue horse. Bottom line, don't discredit that man for his knowledge that he's been in the garage with his father, mega time world champion drag racer, his whole life learning all the things he's learned, because that's what you're doing. I said, you want to beat Billy Glidden? Start beating him. Start building your car to go as fast as his. Do things. Quit worrying about what he's doing, because the rule book's the rule book. So start building to get ahead of him on race day.
Speaking of Billy Glidden, you saw where he came back and raced in the NMCA recently, right?
Oh, yeah. He took Tony Gillick out. Isn't that incredible, the old black car?
With the black car in basically Outlaw 632 with a small motor, just walks out there and crushes everybody.
Isn't that incredible? But I've walked the track with him in Orlando. I learned so much by talking to that man. It isn't just, oh, here I am with my Mustang. We'd walk the track, and I'd wanted to know, because I wanted to know, what is this guy? How does he think? And I walked the track, and he goes, hey, Tucci, you see this? And there'd be a big crack in the track, right? He goes, you know, I run a stick shift, right? I go, yeah. He goes, so how many feet from this there to there? I go, well, I don't know, 20 feet maybe. He goes, that's right about when I'm going to hit second gear, so what should I do? I go, put a gear in it so you can go 30 feet and hit second gear so you don't blow the tire off. And hitting the crack, he goes, exactly. He goes, that's what I'm doing. And the guy would come up, Brian, and he would sit behind me and watch. He'd put his car last in the line. There'd be 60-something cars ready to qualify, and he just watched the eighth mile mark. He'd watch everybody, how fast they ran to the eighth. And he knew I can beat almost everyone because I can run way faster to the eighth of a mile. I always thought he was being arrogant when his chutes would come out early. I'm like, God, there he goes again, putting his chutes in your face. He said, no. Why? He told me I do that because why should I be unsafe? I don't do that. And he goes, my car's right at its limit. I know I got the guy covered and I'm pulling the chute because I'm not going to beat up the car, you know, take a chance of, you know, going any faster than I need to.
Oh yeah. Besides that, he doesn't want to show his full hand. That's the old Ricky Smith trick. Throw those chutes early when you know you got it, so everybody else doesn't know how much you got.
Absolutely. And you know what? That's a gift that they all deserve to have. The harder you work, the more you should be cherished by people instead of shunned.
Oh,
I believe that. I mean, there's too many guys in this sport. Oh, look at him though. He's got all the money. You know what? He worked for the money. Someone didn't just drop it in his hand. Obviously, he's got a good business, but he still has to race that car from A to B.
Oh, yeah. It's the thing that bothers me about some people with drag racing in general is that they think that if you complain loud enough on the internet or in person that you can legislate prosperity for all people, and that's not how it works. You can't just throw your wallet at a car. You can have all the best equipment, but if you don't know how to make it work, you're going to be screwed. You got to put the time in and refine your combination and understand how to make it go fast.
Absolutely.
That is the only way, period. End of discussion. You know, that's the 11th commandment of drag racing right there. Run your stuff. That's it.
Yeah, there was one, you know, they're always saying how to change things. And obviously this would take money, but you know what I'd love to see in this sport? If someone had all the money to do it, I would love to see like they had in NASCAR. Remember the IROC series?
Oh.
I would love to see 10 69 Chevrolet Chevelles with 10.5 true 10.5 tires on it. I'd love to see John Force get one of them. So they're all identical. All you can do is air pressure, make some adjustments. You got to go out and drag race the car. Let's say they all run 890s, whatever. I would love to see the best at what they do getting those cars and on a Sunday. I think it would be so entertaining. I know it costs money, but man, that would be so cool for this sport because it would really show. And what it really would do is show a John Force, you know, or an Antron Brown or something. Wow, man, these ain't easy. These little nitrous or whatever, turbocharge or whatever they are, this ain't easy to do. You know, you got to get out there and be right on it, and hopefully it hooks up. You know, it just take you back to when you built a fast car as a kid, right? And you spin in the tires. Well, I got to get rid of the Farm and Fleet tires and get slicks.
That idea was actually it's something that it's floating around that I was actually going to do an editorial on for Dragzine. That it was the similar idea with the IROC, but instead of, you know, a heads-up style car, bring them all into something where they did that thing with the Toyota Camrys, and then they tried to do it with, you know, the Camaros to Warren Johnson, you know, put one in the wall. But
yeah,
but something similar to that where you have, you know, someone like a Luke Bagaki, a high-level bracket racer. You know, you have someone like Stevie Jackson. You bring in all of these different racers, and then you sprinkle in some of the, you know, the circle burners and guys like that. And you make it a true IROC tournament kind of deal. you know, and just see who is the best pure driver, you know.
Now that's even better. Now would it be the same car? Everybody has the same car.
Yeah. I would even go as far to limit it to like maybe like the same, like what they did with that NHRA deal down at Gainesville, maybe like make it fun, make it like instead of Camrys, make it like 6 Corvettes, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
And they got to go through and cycle through them. That would be interesting to see that kind of happen in the smack talk and everything else. That would be one of those things where you could sell some tickets for people to check it out for sure.
Yeah, I think that's just, you know, I wasn't even thinking of the Camrys and the Camaros, and I know they do that, but I was just thinking, excuse me, I was just thinking how cool it would be, right, to have some old Camaros or Chevelles.
Oh, yeah, totally.
I'm sorry, I gotta get some water here, hold on.
Yeah, I would totally pay to watch something like that, to see all these great racers battle it out in some form of like that. That would be a dog and pony show to check out for sure.
Oh, it'd only make the industry better for anything, for the engines guys, the tranny guys, the people that sponsored it and put the money into it. That's the whole thing. It's just going to take money to do it. But whoever did it, it would just be so cool to see. I mean, it's just not your local Chevy dealer giving a Camaro and, you know, someone takes it off traction control and the thing wants to burn the tires for a quarter of a mile. You know, you just, I think you make it where the guy really has to get in, gets a one lap in the car, you know, on a Thursday night or something to see how it works. And then Friday night, that's it. They pick hats, you know, out of the hat, and they get the car they're supposed to drive and they go.
Oh, it'd be interesting for sure.
Oh, man, what a write-up, huh?
Well, Al, our time here on the Dragzine podcast is coming to an end, and I like to give all my guests an opportunity to do their best John Force impersonation and give shout-outs to, you know, where they can be found out on social media and, you know, what events they got going on and everything else, Al. So the floor is yours. Let let our listeners know where they can find you at and what you got going on.
All right. Thank you so much. I'll tell you what, you can get me on Facebook at Al Tucci, T-U-C-C-I, and that's usually the most I do on the internet, all for the racing and the spectators. And I'm with the Midwest Pro Mod Association right now and having a good time watching that 8th mile deal and how good it is to see the mix of turbos, nitrous and blowers, roots and pro chargers all coming into running within a 10th of each other. It makes for great drag racing. We'll be at Ennis the 17th through the 20th. My first ever NHRA invitation to announce the Midwest Pro Mods. And then I get to end it all in November for the Mel Ross Streetcar Super Nationals, which I've done for at least 15 years, I think, maybe 14. And we'll see where it leads till next year. It's always new for me. You know, I've done, like I said, PDRA, ADRL. I've been at all of them. And it's just a treat to have the fans still accepting me, you know, the ones that will. But I thank you, Brian, on behalf of Dragzine. I tell you what, I thank you so much. It's been a treat to be on your show tonight.
Appreciate it, Al, coming on. Thank you so much. And, you know, check folks, make sure you check Al out on his Facebook and, you know, check out the Midwest Pro Mod Series and look to see you at the track soon, Al.
Take care, Brian.
Thanks. Well, that wraps up the show for this week. Thanks for Al for stopping on by and doing some talking with us. And as always, may your reaction times be crisp and your win lights bright. Until next week, folks.